Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Ross, Judge Larkin, the Honorable Jeffrey Bryan presiding. Calling our first case, A221057, Fitness International LLC, opponent versus City Center Ventures LLC, respondent.
All right, thank you. May be seated. Good morning to you both. Welcome. We are here. We have three cases scheduled for oral argument this morning, November 29th, beginning with the case we just called. I'm sure you're both familiar with how things work. If you use the podium in the middle, that's adjustable. And if you choose to use one of the other podiums, I think those are pretty fixed. And you can't move them up or down very easily. Before you begin, I would ask you to take a moment, not just to state your name for our audio recording, but also, if necessary, help us to pronounce your name and that of your client so that we can pronounce it properly during the argument. And if there's any other additional identifying information you think we need to know about how to refer to you or your client, please take a moment and let us know that as well. And with that, are we prepared to proceed?
We are, Your Honor.
All right. Go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors. Grant Phelan on behalf of Appellant Fitness International, LLC. May it please the court, my client does business here in Minnesota as LA Fitness and runs a fitness center. Before the court today is a dispute that dates back to 2020 when the governor issued certain orders that prevented us from operating the fitness center full stop. This was not a situation where we closed voluntarily. This was not a situation like some experienced where we could open partially. We weren't able to do online fulfillment. We were not able to even use the center in any capacity whatsoever. As a result of my client not getting the benefit of its bargain, it brought suit here in Hennepin County, claiming that it was relieved from the duty to pay rent on a temporary basis. And what I mean by that is that for 130 months from the inception of this lease in 2007 until April of 2020, my client paid rent one time, every time, for the privilege of using commercial property. We did this after we spent $3.5 million constructing the building specifically to house a fitness center. And in April, we said we're no longer able to use the fitness center in violation of express covenants, express representations, express guarantees embedded in the lease that were agreed to in an arm's length transaction between two sophisticated parties. Landlord, under the threat of eviction, insisted that we pay to preserve our rights. We paid under protest. We brought suit. Now, respectfully,
well, can I just jump in and make sure? You did pay, or the client, your client did perform its requirements, the payment of rent.
Correct. So we paid rent. We sent a letter along with it, said we're reserving our rights, we're paying under protest, because in one of those catch-22 situations. As this court knows, a lot of the common law defenses that would otherwise relieve my client of the obligation to pay rent.
And you're not making any argument that that act, the payment of rent, was hindered or, I mean, it's...
No, yeah. No. We're not suggesting that our ability to pay rent was prevented, right? We could still write a check. What we're saying is that the principal purpose of this lease, which is represented in Section 1.9, represented in Section 2.2, which essentially was to operate a fitness center and gym, was frustrated that there were reps, warranties, and covenants that were breached, and that relieved us of the obligation. So we filed suit. The parties moved for cross motions for summary judgment. The trial court ultimately found against us. Now, here I think the trial court respectfully got it wrong. And it got it wrong for a number of reasons. First, when you look to section 1.9 of the lease, and this is what the parties agreed to. This is what the parties essentially said was the benefit of the bargain, was that we were going to use this property as a fitness center in gym. And within 1.9, one of the representations, one of the warranties, one of the covenants that landlord made to us, right? Landlord hereby represents in covenants to tenant, a tenant's operation of the building, of the business from the building for a health club and fitness center does not and will not violate any restrictions on use within the project. So that's representation number one. It turned out to be false. And while landlord would have you believe that it's not their fault, and I'm not suggesting it is, that doesn't matter when it comes to this lease. Because on the heels of that representation, warranty, and covenant, the landlord further said, tenant shall, not may, not could, shall have the right throughout the term. So not just at the beginning, not in the middle, but throughout the entire term to operate the premises or any portion thereof for uses permitted under this lease. And that, of course, is embodied in the very section where they say, what are you going to use this for? A fitness center and gym. Now, the trial court would have you believe that because in section 8.2 and 8.3, we reserve the right to change our purpose down the road, that somehow that obligated us to actually change the purpose of the lease when we actually were forced to close. Now, respectfully, that's not the law in Minneapolis. It's not the law in St. Paul. It's not the law in Sydney Center. It's not the law anywhere here in Minnesota. The idea that we could reserve a right under the lease and then be forced to invoke it when a right has already been taken from us. Remember that the reason that we spent $3 million to build a fitness center, the reason that we paid $84,000 a month, was not so that we could use it for some other purpose. It was to use it as a fitness center and gym. Now, lest there be any mistake, the parties actually went on in section 2.2 of the lease and said there were further representations, warranties, and covenants that the parties agreed to. In fact, they say that landlord was making them as an inducement for my client to enter into this lease. Each of them being material and each of them surviving execution. So what do we know? They're important. They're being made to get us to enter into the lease, and that they continue throughout the lease. So what were those representations, warranties, and covenants that were so important? Landlord has good and insurable, fee simple title to the project. Now we know what title is, right? And respectfully, I think this is where the trial court got a little far afield. The trial court got into title defects. Title, as we know, is that bundle of sticks that you're first-year property professor told you about. The idea that you would own something a certain way, in this case, fee simple title, you would have that bundle of sticks which would allow you to lease the property, take a stick, give it to my client, which was temporary use of the property. So landlord here was representing, warranting, and covenanting, not that just that its title report would be free, but that its ownership would be free. Of all, free and clear of all conditions and restrictions. Now, just not any condition restriction, all conditions and restrictions which might in any manner or to any extent prevent or adversely affect the use of the premises by tenant for tenant's intended purposes. There's that phrase again, the use of the premises. The trial court seemed to suggest, in its opinion, that the moment possession was transferred to my client, that landlord no longer had any obligations. And that may have been true, but for these representations and warranties, which don't appear in isolated sections of the lease, they're repeated on and on and on. They also said these conditions and restrictions will not interfere with tenants' intended purposes or disturb tenants' peaceful and quiet possession and enjoyment thereof. Now, what's interesting about 2.2, when the trial court judge referenced 2.2, there's another covenant of quiet use and enjoyment that's embedded at the end of the paragraph. The court actually skipped over this language, which said that there would be no conditions or restrictions which would disturb tenants' peaceful and quiet possession and enjoyment thereof, in favor of a secondary, an additional covenant of quiet use and enjoyment, which speaks to the landlord's interference with our covenant of quiet use and enjoyment, essentially restating what is the common law. And here, I submit that not only did the trial court get it wrong because it referred to the wrong standard, but it also ignored the fact that the parties took the time to set forth both standards. It wasn't just that landlord was warranting, coveting, and guaranteeing that it wouldn't interfere, but it was also warranting, covenanting, and guaranteeing that there would be no restrictions, no conditions that would interfere with our use. Now, why is all this important? This is important because in our industry, we try to build habits. We believe, and science will tell you, that if we can get somebody to come to the gym, develop a healthy lifestyle for 2 weeks, they come 2 weeks, we have them, right? They'll come back, they'll enjoy the gym. And when it's interrupted, when that two-week habit is interrupted, if Mr. McBride was a member of the gym, no matter how much he promised he was coming back, if it's interrupted, he's gonna go down the street. He's gonna go somewhere else.
Can I ask you to focus? Sorry.
I think for your rebuttal, I'm gonna ask that you both use the central, the adjusting.
Sure.
Yeah, if you wanna move over to that podium.
Happy to do so.
I think there's some issue with the microphone, so I'm gonna turn down our speakers a little bit.
I turned that one down.
Okay, thank you.
Try this again, okay. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely.
All right.
Fine.
I'd like to ask you to take a moment and clarify whether you're arguing that the hindrance to the possession or enjoyment was by the landlord, and if not, you're arguing then that it is by some other person through, under, or by the landlord,
but,
and which is it? And then whichever it is, go ahead and make your argument as to how the executive order would be by, through, and under, if that is where you're at.
Well, so, and Judge, you raise a good point that maybe I was not clear enough. If you actually look to Section 2.2, there are two references to our ability to use the property without interruption. You know, I call them quiet use and enjoyment covenants, but the reality is that they are distinctly different. We're not suggesting that the landlord caused, contributed, or even wanted Governor Walz to issue an order telling us to shut down. That's not our argument at all. Our argument is that they made promises, they made representations, they made covenants, and this is not a referendum on whether or not they should have, but they made these promises that there would be no conditions, no restrictions that interfered with our ability to use the property. So if you see 2.2, subsection B specifically, it actually sets forth both, Judge. So in the middle of the paragraph, it says, there will be no conditions or restrictions which disturb tenants' peaceful and quiet possession and enjoyment thereof. There's no qualification. There's no buy through or under the landlord. And then if you go down to the end of that same paragraph, there's the language that you were referring to, which speaks to the interference coming from buy through or under the landlord, and speaking specifically to ejectment. So there are two different covenants that are being made. And as you know, under Minnesota law, we try to give effect to every part of the contract. So the only reason
that— Are you making any argument under the second part of section 2.2B?
We are not.
So purely the part that relates to good and insurable title, that there's that dispute about what that means?
Right.
Okay.
So we're saying they represented they had ownership without restriction, without condition. Now, this also leads me into a frustration of purpose impossibility argument, which are common law arguments which this state adopted long ago. Here, we know what the principal purpose was for landlord and tenant of this specific lease. And what frustration of purpose says in Minnesota is when the principal purpose is substantially frustrated without fault, his remaining duties, my client's remaining duties to render performance are discharged either on a permanent basis under the restatement second of contract section 265 or on a temporary basis, as we've argued here, under subsection 269 of the restatement second of contracts. And I think what's important here is that you
And I'll ask you just to wrap up with this point because you're out of time and you'll have a few minutes for rebuttal.
So I think it's important to understand the difference between impossibility and frustration of purpose, both of which I submit apply here. Impossibility is when we can't perform, right, because the governor said you have to shut down. Frustration of purpose is when the other party can't perform and I've lost the benefit of my bargain. Here, in this instance, I did not get the benefit of my bargain, which was the ability to use the property.
Okay. Thank you.
Your Honors, good morning. May it please the court, my name is John Steffenhagen. I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent in this case. The lease in this case sets forth the specific terms required by Fitness International in the precise language that it itself drafted. There is nothing in the lease agreement that makes City Center responsible for temporary changes in law arising from Governor Walz's executive order. Now, those are not my words. That is an almost verbatim recitation from this court in the published decision in SVAP3, Riverdale Commons. Same rationale holds true in this case. Since this is a lease case, the analysis starts with the language itself. Now, Fitness International has made an argument. It calls its sole purpose without a basis in the lease. They say that the sole purpose is the operation of a fitness center and health facility. In the reply memorandum, they go further and say that it was the party's shared purpose, their word again, that Fitness International would operate a health club on the premises. In whatever semantic iteration they choose, this is simply factually incorrect. Paragraph 8.1 specifically says that Fitness International was required to use the premises for only one day as a fitness center. Article 8.2 says that after that first day, Fitness International could utilize the property for whatever purpose they chose. Indeed, under paragraph 8.2, they bargained for the right to cease the use of the premises altogether. So Fitness International chose not to exercise those rights that it negotiated and drafted. This is a business decision by Fitness International. It is not a claim against City Center. These are not the only lease provisions that compel affirmance of the grant of summary judgment in this case. For example, Article 8.3 of the lease provides that Fitness International covenanted, not agreed, but covenanted, that it would not use the space for an unlawful purpose. This court utilized the same rationale in the SVAP case, where the tenant was required to, quote, comply with any and all requirements of any public authority and with state or federal law. Simply put, no matter what arguments they make, no matter what semantics are employed, they agreed to comply with the law.
Is there any argument in your view that there's some ambiguity in the contract?
I don't believe so, no.
I should make my question better.
Less ambiguous.
Yes, thank you. Do you think that Fitness International is making any argument that there's an ambiguity in the contract?
They haven't, which is interesting. Because
and is it City Center's position that the contract is also unambiguous?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Fitness International itself argued before the district court that the contract was unambiguous. So we're certainly arguing that it is unambiguous in City Center's favor, without question. We are not arguing, nor do we accept, that it is unambiguous in Fitness International's favor. Further, the lease specifically defines land defaults. That's Article 19.7. A default occurs if City Center, quote, fails to perform any of its obligations here under, unquote. There's no evidence that City Center undertook any affirmative act or conduct that breached an obligation. The terms, moreover, of the lease are severable, which means that if any provision is found to be illegal, among other things, Fitness International agreed that all other terms are affected and fully enforceable. So during the temporary period of Governor Walz's orders, if any provision was unlawful, illegal, as operating a fitness center would have been, then Fitness International expressly agreed that all other terms remained in place. Now, the force majeure clause, paragraph 22.3, similarly supports summary judgment in favor of City Center. That provision expressly includes reference to restrictive laws. So, in other words, the parties contemplated that there could be restrictive laws that would be in play. The parties further provided and delineated their...
What kind of restrictive laws do you think could be in play that would prevent one party from paying rent?
That would prevent a party from paying rent. I don't believe there would be a restrictive law that would prevent the payment of rent, because that's the concluding sentence, ironically, of Article 22.3, which accepts from the definition of a force majeure event things that can be cured by the payment of money. Now, in this case, there was a restrictive law. In this case, Fitness International concedes it has the ability to pay, and hence that last sentence of Article 22.3 does not apply. Moreover, they could pay rent, and thus, pursuant to simply Article 22.3, the judgment should be affirmed as well. Now, Fitness International has taken conflicting and multiple positions in its litigation nationwide regarding the interpretation of the force majeure clause. Moreover, force majeure is an affirmative defense. It is not an affirmative claim for disgorgement of rent. Hence, it's barred by...
I understand that there's not much authority to support using force majeure in the way that Fitness International is using it, but are you aware of any authority that says, just as you said, that it can't be used in the way that Fitness International is trying to avail itself? Okay.
Yes, Your Honor, I am. That was the same precise issue addressed and decided against Fitness International in the Federal District Court in California. I believe it was the SPE Store Fitness International case that specifically held that the force majeure was an affirmative defense and not an affirmative claim. Hence, the answer to Your Honor's question is yes. But even leaving apart all of those provisions that flat out bar Fitness International's claim, it fares no better under the isolated provisions that it does address. Now, Fitness International talks and defines, capitalizes the term promises and guarantees as though that is a defined term in the lease. It is not. In reality, Fitness International relies upon only two provisions of the lease. Neither of them are applicable in this case. For example, paragraph 2.2b provides, opening a sentence, that landlord has good and insurable title. It does. It had good and insurable title when the lease was entered. It had it when Governor Walz issued the executive orders. It has it today. There is no allegation of a title defect. If that were in fact the law, then every single property owner, every health center, every restaurant, every business that was impacted by COVID would have a title defect. They have cited no law for that premise. As this court noted this morning, paragraph 2.2b also says that they shall have possession without any ejection by landlord or by any other person by, through, or under landlord. Now, no such thing happened in this case. They always had possession. Governor Wall certainly did not act. Fitness International, City Center, certainly did not act by, through, or under Governor Walz. Paragraph 2.2b is inapplicable. So too is paragraph 1.9. Now this clause is standard in commercial leases. There's nothing exceptional about this. It starts with the premise that Fitness International had an initial use, that's its term, of a health club and fitness facility. It did. That too is undisputed. About two-thirds of the way down in that clause City Center represented that this use did not violate any agreements regarding exclusive use rights or restrictions on use. Now, what we heard this morning was a partial quotation focusing on the terms rights or restrictions on use. That term, however, is specifically called out in paragraph 1.9 as agreements that regard exclusive use or restrictions on use. That is the language that Fitness International drafted. There are no agreements in this case, nothing in the record to suggest in any respect that there was an agreement regarding exclusive use or restrictions on use. There's no fact issue in that regard. Now, as a fallback argument, Fitness International makes several common law arguments. None of those supersede or vitiate the fact that it drafted a lease under which it has no claim. For example, impossibility and impracticability of performance. This requires the doctrine that impossibilities must be unforeseeable when the contract is entered. Now, in this case, however, the force majeure clause specifically recognizes and contemplates restrictive laws. Further, performance was never impossible or impractical in the slightest degree. At any time, Fitness International had the option of simply utilizing an alternate use. It decided not to do so. It bargained for that right. Excuse me. It bargained for that flexibility, but simply failed to use it. So however much Fitness International says that it invested in this property, that's its own business decision. So too is its decision not to utilize any alternate use. I want to talk briefly too about the renovation contribution. This is Fitness International's add-on claim for $6,250 in interest. Now, what is happening here is that Fitness International is attempting to mix and match two fully integrated contracts. The renovation contribution was specified in the amendment to the lease, not the lease itself. There is nothing in the amendment that says my client is obligated to pay interest. An interest provision is, however, in the fully integrated lease. However, they can't pick and choose. The lease also contains an express provision that requires a notice of default. That did not occur in this case. Finally, with the time I have remaining and the voice I have left, I'll discuss the issue of attorney fees. The lease specifically provides for the award of attorney fees. My client followed General Rule Practice 119, and the court entered judgment accordingly. Fitness International had the ability to contest, to make its arguments before the district court, and never did. Now, they will say that the district court entered judgment perhaps too quickly, in their words. That's not the case. Fitness International was before the court on motion practice 6 weeks after the cost and fee judgment was entered. Fitness International could have made a record. It could have moved for amended findings under Rule 52.02. It could have moved pursuant to Rule 60, and it didn't either. So not only did it not contest the procedure, it did not contest the substance. Even on appeal, it does not contest the substance of the award. Hence, if there was any error in procedure, it is harmless since on appeal, they have not identified, excuse me, any substantive argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors, and thank you for the opportunity to come and speak to you here today. Just briefly, counsel made reference to a district court opinion out of California called the Store case and cited it for the proposition that there is a there's case law out there that says that I can't use force majeure or frustration of purpose or impossibility or impracticability as an affirmative claim. I was lead counsel on the Store case. It was a year ago today that we were actually preparing to try that case in Southern California, and the ruling came down. The distinction between that case and the reason why the court held the way it did in Store was because we didn't pay under protest. And the court said, you don't have any damages. You can't assert an affirmative claim when you haven't paid anything. And that's why the court held the way it did. So with all due respect to counsel, he probably
would. I mean, the flip side of my question is still sort of applicable to you, which is there any authority on which you can rely that allows one party who did perform to say that the other party's non-performance was a result of force majeure or a result of you know, it's impossible or impracticable for that party to perform, and therefore I get refunded?
Sure. Well, in what, that,
where's that case?
Well, that's the whole reason for a declaratory judgment cause of action, right? Where there's a dispute between the parties regarding their respective.
Where's the authority that allows one party who performed to come back and say it was the other party's performance that was hindered? Where's the authority for that? And I'm looking for Minnesota binding authority.
If you can't find any,
then we'll look beyond our borders. But I didn't see any cited.
Candidly, I didn't see any either.
You think then, if we agree with you, that we should publish or make this case precedential?
Well, I think you should, right? Because this creates that catch-22 situation that I was speaking about for tenants, right? How do you preserve your rights under a lease dispute without running the risk of losing the property under an unlawful detainer action? Because under the SVAP decision, which counsel was referencing, that was an unlawful detainer action. And this court said you can't argue frustration of purpose, you can't argue impossibility, you can't argue impracticability. Now, in the footnote, on footnote number two in that decision, it specifically said those defenses are left here for money damages. But there's no way around the idea.
I think the question is, if there's something that prevents the tenant from paying rent, for example, their account has been frozen for some reason,
sure,
right? They're unable to make that transaction, their non-performance could be excused. It is a defense. If you were sued for breach of contract and you're the tenant as opposed to some kind of eviction action or there's some other contractual dispute, those defenses. But I was looking for any situation where one party has performed or could have performed and they're not saying that their performance was hindered. It's that the other party's performance was hindered and therefore they should get a refund or they're excused. I didn't see that case.
Well, and again, that's the whole, and you raise the interesting issue, the difference between force majeure, which is a contractual right that is bargained between the parties and that each are different. There is no hard and fast rule that says, well, you have a force majeure clause or you made reference to restrictive laws, so therefore it displaces and is effective in every instance where there's a dispute over a restrictive use. That's not what the law says. That's not what 22.3 in the lease says. Likewise, when you're talking about frustration of purpose and impossibility and impracticability, there's no way a tenant can advance those claims without losing the property because this court has said in that summary proceeding, You cannot advance those as defenses. You have to bring them in this action for money damages. So that's why I believe the law has to be, even though there hasn't been a decision published to this point, it has to be, because there would be no other way for my client to preserve these rights and to preserve the benefit of their bargain. Now, when you're talking about frustration of purpose,
and your time has concluded, so I'll let you give us your final word.
I think the court needs to remember that what we're talking about here is the principal purpose for entering into the lease, not where there are other potential uses. We shouldn't be penalized for reserving other rights under the lease where there's been no evidence that's been offered by the landlord that suggests that there was a viable other use under Governor Wall's order. We were told to go home. We went home. We followed the law. We lost the benefit of our bargain. That's why we're here. Thank you.
Thank you very much.